Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today on the show, we'll go from girl gangs to Georgia O'Keeffe, and from legendary luthiers to Martin Luther King Jr. First up, North Carolina A&T State University takes its audience on an up-close and in-your-face tour of the mean streets of America with its production of Breath Boom by Kia Corthran. Then, he's worked on guitars used by Neil, Eric, and Elvis. Yes, those Neil, Eric, and Elvises. Legendary Carolina luthier and picker Wayne Henderson is here to reveal the secrets of his success. Granola House reveals the magic behind American moderns like Grandma Moses and Norman Rockwell. And the Stained Glass Playhouse celebrates National Black History Month with a powerful and personal look at the civil rights movement through the eyes of award-winning playwright Gloria Bond Clooney. She helps us find our own inner North Star next on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got a great show for you today with theater, music, and visual art on the menu. And we begin by taking a deep breath.
Can you picture my prophecy? Stress in the city, the cops are stopping me. The project's full of bullets, the bodies is dropping. There ain't no stopping me. Constantly moving while making millions. Witnessing killers, leaving dead bodies in the bed.
Breath Boom by Kia Corthran comes to the Paul Robeson Theater on the A&T campus in Greensboro, courtesy of the North Carolina A&T State University Department of Visual and Performing Arts. This hard-hitting, in-your-face play chronicles a cycle of violence and abuse that leads girls in the mean streets of the Bronx to join gangs. Pree, played by A&T actor Brittany Timmons, struggles to come to terms with her own inner demons during her 14 years as a girl gang leader. Brittany is joined by A&T actor Mia Sims, who plays Kat, a young girl vying to join Pree's gang, and rapper actor Allison Wilson, who narrates with an original rap written for the play by A&T's Kirk Hill. We'll also hear from beatboxers Trey Riley and Julia Smith, Breath Boom director and A&T Theater Arts Program adjunct assistant professor Donna Baldwin Bradby, and A&T Justice and Political Science professor and technical consultant Dr. Ernest Culthbertson. The scene and music from Breath Boom that the actors will share with us depict acts of gang violence.
You ever seen explosions at night? Cause once the boom shakes the room, it's a party, alright. I got my girls banging with me, not a hater in sight. Once we let the spark light, everybody wanna fight. I bet you get excited once the flame is ignited. But don't be messing with my gang if you wasn't invited. I got some things to do, rolling with my crew. We got Malika, we got Tommy, we got Angel too. And let's talk about me, a lady named Pree. Been friends with fireworks since about 83. It was there when nobody ever cared about me. Never cared about my feelings, so I never let them see. But now I got my gang whenever I call. And when they not, I'm just painting perfect pictures on the walls. Since my angles like a tiger just raided them all. To kill the stress of it all, I just stop, take a breath and let it boom. Light it up, let it spark, watch it blow. Take a breath and let it boom. Light it up, let it spark, watch it blow. Take a breath and let it boom.
What's the big one, Pree? Single most thing earned you all the gracious undivided esteem. I heard this. Shot an enemy girl in the face, then went to her funeral because y'all was best friends second grade. Made all your sisters go, put the whole family on edge. And every one of them knew, and not a one of them said a word about it to you. And one time jumping a girl in, she not too conscious. You jump your whole weight on her face 10 times, maybe 12 for a sister pull you off. And we all stand around, eeny, meeny, miny, pick some herb, coming down the subway steps into their wallet. You was the one everybody know could always knock him out first punch. And one time, on a revenge spree, dress up like a man so no one identify you later. Stick your hair under a cap and shoot dead some boy 10 years old.
15. I don't kill no kids. 15.
Oh, gee. You gonna earn it. Original gangster. People respect you long after you retire. Take me in. You get it. The high, right? This girl, Leah, she tell me all about it. The kicking and smashing and breaking bones. Snap. Somebody lying still in a flood of their own blood. Somebody dead, it gets her all hyped up, thrill thing, and power. Them dead, you not, you made it happen. Them dead, you done it. You ever get that high?
Of course.
Take me in. I tried once. Not yours, not the other neither. I ain't enemy. Small little club I was interested in. Wore the right colors. They wouldn't even jump me in. I said, I'll do it. Either way, all y'all stand in a line, rough me through it, or I'll take the toughest one on 2 minutes. They just laugh. Maybe when we out, I know there's lots and lots of members, big network, your group. Maybe I'd be good running with my sisters, tapping the codes.
Wannabe.
They think I ain't tough. I got it. I can fight. I was 4, these 2 boys were 6. Tried to steal my bike, I flattened them. And when my foster sister's steak knife stabbed me and drowned me in the tub, somebody called an ambulance. He mouth-to-mouth me back alive, said if I wasn't strong, I'd have stayed dead. She's dead. Jessie, she the one screaming, hold her down. No air bubbles. Hold her till she dead. Look who's talking. She with her homegirls and boys thinking she a member in good standing. Got drunk one night and said something smart to a homie. He blew her head off.
You ever wish you'd done it?
Huh?
You ever regret? Wasn't you pulled that trigger?
She's dead.
Yeah, but like, that thought, fantasy, it ever get stuck in your mind? Wishing the last thing she seen was you robbing her last breath.
I'm going to get listeners up to speed on who these characters are. I'll turn to you first, Kat. So you're trying to get in on the gang.
Yes, I am.
Okay. Who is Kat and why does she want to get in on this gang?
Kat is the cellmate of Pri, and she really just wants to belong, but she's also looking for a mother figure. And when she shares the cell with Pri, Pri kind of steps in that role for her.
Gotcha. And Pri, you're skeptical, but you seem to be kind of leaning her way in this one. What's on your mind in assessing Kat in this scene?
With Kat, for some reason, Pri's guard is completely down when it comes to Kat. Pri kind of likes Kat. Does she let her know that? No. But I like Kat for some reason. She allows me to open up a little bit, being that she opens up with me. She's not this hostile person, so therefore Pri doesn't feel like she needs to be hostile with her. So it's just something that I like about Kat, but I just can't let her in on that.
Okay. And this is, but that comes across. There's just like a wry smile, even when you're saying the words that I can kind of hear in there, that you're leaning her way. The character Pri up against a whole lot at home, and how does she process that and wind up drifting into gangs?
Pri is a confused little girl. Well, once she was a confused little girl that had no family to turn to. Her mom was either chasing drugs or chasing men. And therefore, Pri felt empty when it came to her household and her family. So therefore, she went out seeking family in other ways, which was the gang. The gang became my family, my sisters, the OGs before me, the original gangsters before me, became my mother or my father or my aunts and people that wasn't there. So that's why Pri is the way she is. Her mother's boyfriend was very sexually abusive to her. He was also abusive to the mother. It's a lot of things that she tries to cover up. It's a lot of people she doesn't let in, even some of her gang members. But it's just a shield that Pri had to create for herself. Does she want to let it down? Yes. But she doesn't know if she should or she doesn't know if she can.
Hmm. Mia, approaching this play through this whole education process and then learning the roles, what have you learned that's kind of going to stick with you?
Definitely that many people view a gang as not an option, but like it's the only way, it's the only route they have. And so they just view it as a natural step or a natural part of life where they're like, this is just something that happens and it happens to everyone they know. They don't see outside of that. And Kat, even though she's not in the gang, she's been in the vicinity of them, and that goes with her everywhere. And she sees that, people, they go through things, but they stick together and they're close, and that's what she wants. And so it draws her to that. And I've noticed in my research and in rehearsals that affects a lot, like her mentality and her psychologically.
It really casts the question about this whole equal playing field. I mean, if you grow up in Compton, in a certain part of Compton, and everyone you know is in the gang, how would you envision heading off to A&T and getting a university degree and that sort of thing?
You probably wouldn't. I don't think the thought would really cross your mind.
Dr. Cuthbertson, talk about your background in political science and I guess your familiarity with this topic.
I've been in and around gangs as far as I can remember. I talked to a group of the students last evening and told them, as far as a childhood memory, that was probably the first one I ever had. I had 2 older brothers. They were involved. My grandparents actually moved us from Greensboro to Philadelphia as a result of my brothers being involved in issues and ultimately, taking us out of an environment and putting us in a worse environment. So you know, from there to going to the West Coast, being in the military. In the military, as a supervisor, I had gang members that I was responsible for. A lot of those guys were given options after getting in trouble in civility, either go into the military or go to prison. So they chose the lesser of two evils. And even with that, I was just really drawn to the whys. Why do people join? Why is it so problematic? And why aren't there more resources in the communities to help redirect and to deal with this as a social issue? From there, you know, I just invoked on a pilgrimage of what can I do, first and foremost, to educate the community, law enforcement, policymakers? How can I make a difference? And ultimately, it's been an evolution that hadn't stopped yet.
Well, education seems like that would be so important in terms of understanding the socio-political issues behind what drives someone to join a gang. If you're growing up in that environment, I guess the choices seem, as mentioned earlier, clear. But what are some of the forces that would have somebody choose that path?
Well, I think some of the things, socioeconomic conditions are really the cornerstone when you talk about gangs. The majority of gang members, not all, but the majority will come from a single-parent home. Due to that, we have a large populace in this country of what we define as latchkey children, meaning for a given period of the day, you know, those kids are unsupervised. And as a result of being unsupervised, 9 times out of 10, the parents are either working multiple jobs or single jobs, so the kids have that time to engage in whatever they like. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be those activities in the street, hanging out, skipping school, where problems are easy to access and to get into. And it takes very little. I told the students last night in California, especially in Los Angeles and LA County, you know, most young people are introduced to the criminal justice system off of a $250 jaywalking ticket. Wow. Meaning, if you can't pay that ticket, you're introduced to the cycle. And, you know, it constitutes with gang injunctions, you know, 3 people or more standing on the street corner, identified like or similar type colors, constitutes a street gang. So it takes very little to identify a person as such, but it takes even more to remove them from sane.
Once you enter this tract, it struck me watching some of the documentaries on gang membership, particularly with females' involvement, right, that you're essentially robbed of a childhood.
Correct.
How does that impact one moving forward then?
Well, I think it impacts people greatly because a lot of these young people, they don't have the time or they've never had the fortune of being children. In a latchkey situation, you have children that take on adult type responsibilities. If there's 3 or 4 siblings in a house, that eldest sibling probably has the responsibility of taking care of the younger 3, in addition to cooking for them, helping with homework and everything else. It's such a dynamic problem. And in order to address it, it has to be tackled by organizations, groups, churches, policymakers, the community at large to deal with if you have an identifiable problem.
This is to you, Springfield Hottest Crew, Thug Life, YGs, sending their respects, you know what I mean? Life forever, you're always gonna be, no matter what, don't forget that. I pray before I go to sleep.
This play really traces the life of Pree through mm-hmm. early teen years and through the age of 30, where she's leading this gang for an incredibly long time.
Yes.
What happens at 30 that changes things?
It starts when she's 16, and she is the leader of the gang. As Professor Cuthbertson says, she's put her work in, and that's why she's considered an original gangster. What's important are her gang members around her. As they get older, the other gang members evolve. They are still involved in activity, but in a minor way, and they have children and have jobs. But Pree, in my opinion, stays in the same place. She never gets past the gang life. And there's no such thing as aging out of a gang. Her and her mother have never had a great relationship, and her mother ends up going in prison for years. And then her mother comes out of prison, and Pree finds that she has to take care of her mother. That's one of the turning points in her life. She also has an encounter in the park, a random encounter with a young lady in a wheelchair that she beat up years ago. And she put the young lady in the wheelchair, and she can't remember doing this because she's had so many violent encounters. And that's a powerful moment in Pree's life, or she realizes, I have put somebody in a wheelchair. I don't even remember doing this. So there are these multiple things that happen in her life that drive her to change her life to a certain extent. And her stints in prison also. So she takes this amazing, amazing, amazing journey, and it ends with her at 28, and she's having this moment of reconciliation with her mother. So it's a powerful, powerful ending to the play.
Dr. Cuthbertson, from your perspective, what's your assessment of this play, Breath Boom, in terms of accuracy or fantasy? Where does it fall?
I'm really impressed with the play. It's definitely not a West Side Story. You know, and it's definitely not set it off, but it's right there in the middle. And I think the gravity of the play and the realism and the dialogue is just unbelievable. There's a couple things that I've actually talked to the students and the cast members about. Well, you know, they actually would not say this, or they would do this. And, you know, they take it to heart, you know, once it's explained. But I think it's beautiful.
Donna, I'm wondering about your assessment of Kia Corthram's use of language in this play. What sets her apart as a playwright in your eyes?
Kia is a phenomenal playwright. You know, she really focuses on issues, social issues, abuse, violence, disabilities. But one thing she's noted for is the cadence in the way she writes. Some people describe it as sing-songy, and we really are plowing through the language. And it is tough. It is tough language. She chooses to write the way people talk, and seeing that on paper and bringing it to life, it's a hard job. And she's done a powerful job with Breath Boom.
In terms of vocal coaching and getting in the idiom, I mean, how's that been? I mean, talking street language, what's that process been like?
It's daunting. It's just ripping the text apart, pulling out the meaty parts, plowing through with tempo, and making sure that the audiences understand what the actors are saying.
That seems like a fine line to walk.
It is. And it sounds like that's a simple thing, and that's generally what we do as directors. But when you deal with someone like Kia Cawthon's text, it is an event to get through the text. It's a 47-page script. So in the world of script writing, it is short, but a lot happens in those 47 pages.
In an interview I watched earlier today with it was a Newsday critic, Kia spoke about wanting the audience to be, her goal, to be active participants in a way. And I'm wondering how she achieves this in Breath Boom.
Oh, yeah. Everything's in your face. Everything's in your face. And I'm trying to honor that part of her as a writer. I really have to honor the text, but studying her as a writer, looking at interviews with her, I really want to make sure that the audience is up close and personal with the characters. In particular, the violent pieces in the show. We have a fight choreographer who's doing these fights, and I really want to make sure in my blocking where the actors move on stage that they are up close and personal with the violence. So that's one of my goals.
With all this extra stressing, the question I wonder is after death, after my last breath, when will I finally get to rest through this suppression? They punish the people that...
North Carolina A&T State University actors Brittany Timmons, Mia Sims, and Allison Wilson. The original rap, Breath Boom, is by Kirk Hill, who is joined in this recording by beatboxers Trey Riley and Julius Smith. We also heard from A&T Theater Arts Program Adjunct Assistant Professor Donna Baldwin Bradby and A&T Justice and Political Science Professor and Technical Consultant Dr. Ernest Cuthbertson. Kia Corthran's powerful play, Breath Boom, comes to the Paul Robeson Theater on campus Thursday night, February 13th, where it'll run through the 23rd with evening performances at 8 and Sunday matinees at 3. You'll find ticket information and video clips of a live and studio performance of Kirk Hill's Breath Boom rap on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Later on the show, we'll tour American Moderns with Rinola House's Allison Slaby. We'll also join Stained Glass Playhouse director, actor Harold Claytor Jr. in celebrating the many personal sacrifices and struggles behind the civil rights movement. He shares his thoughts on Gloria Bond Clooney's North Star just about 10 minutes from now. But first, it's time for the country, Rugby, Virginia, to be exact. That's where life began for one of world's greatest living luthiers and guitarists, Mr. Wayne Henderson. You'll find Wayne's instrument building work on display at the Mount Airy Museum of Regional History in the exhibit The Luthier's Craft, Instrument Making Traditions of the Blue Ridge. It's a collaborative exhibition between renowned regional luthiers Wayne Henderson, Audrey Hash Ham, Chris Testerman, and Johnny Gentry, and it focuses on the history of building three instruments, guitar, banjo, and fiddle. This weekend, you can check out the luthier's craft during the museum's regular hours, Monday through Saturday, 10 to 5. But the exhibit wraps up Saturday night, February 8th, with a dinner concert. Wayne Henderson and Friends begins at 7 o'clock in the Mount Airy Museum of Regional History. Wayne stopped by WFDD to talk about his guitar work and do a little picking of his own live in Studio A with his good friend, Mr. Herb Key.
Herb, let's do this old tune I learned from Doc Watson, one called Nothing to It.
In addition to being a world-renowned picker, we've got one of the world-renowned luthiers sitting in our studio, and we're talking about working on Neil Young's guitar or working up an instrument for someone by the name of Eric Clapton, just for starters. Take us back. How did it begin for you?
I got started making guitars. I always made stuff when I was a kid. I was raised on a farm where it's pretty common. You have to make things you need to have. Yeah. You know, my dad and grandpa's all could make farm equipment. Stuff you need, but none of them ever made instruments. But when I got to playing music, I wanted one so bad. You know, I mean, I had a real cheap old guitar that was hard to play and all that. And I marveled at Mr. Ball's old Martin, you know, that that was the only good instrument in the community anywhere. But it sure was a good one, though. They wouldn't have been anything better anywhere. Yeah. You know, I didn't have anything to work with, you know, no tools much. And I knew I had to bend wood, and somehow. And the only thing I'd seen a piece of wood bend, there was a piece of veneer on my mom's dresser drawer bottom. I went in there one evening and slipped that thing out of there and laid it out in the creek that ran down behind the house all night. And sure enough, the next morning, that piece of wood had soaked loose and floated down the branch. And I got that veneer out and dried the board off and put it back in there, and Mom never knew anything about her dresser drawer bottom, you know.
Until now.
It wouldn't have mattered, you know, too much anyway, but I didn't know that. And I got that wood, and the only glue I could find is some my dad had stuck weather stripping on his truck door, which was just black sticky stuff, you know. And I worked my whole school vacation when I was about 12 or 13 years old or something, and to work on that guitar, and I was so proud of it. I had it laid out in a back building out there where nobody would see it, and, you know, instrument makers were unheard of then, you know, and I was afraid my dad and all of them would think I'd lost my mind, you know, trying to make a guitar. And anyway, that thing, you know, even up in the mountains up there, when it gets August time, you know, we got some heat and humidity, and it set in on that veneer that still had spring left in it and that old rubber glue. Yeah, then I went out there to check on my guitar to work on it sometime, and it blossomed like a morning glory. It just totally came apart. And I didn't know what to do, and my dad could tell there was something wrong with me, you know, everything. And I finally told him I'd tried to make a guitar and it'd come apart. Mm-hmm. I almost had it done. And so he said, well, you know, the next day it's raining till we can't work on the farm, I'll take you to see Albert Hash, because my dad was an old-time fiddler, and Albert had worked on his fiddle at some time or another, and he knew that he would know what kind of glue to use and stuff like that. Anyway, that went over and saw Albert, and he showed me a fiddle that he had made in 1953, and I could not believe my eyes, you know, that somebody's hands could make that beautiful an instrument. And, you know, he was carved and made out of beautiful curly maple wood, and that gave me the inspiration, because I knew Albert didn't have all that many tools either. So I worked another year on getting that guitar, and sure enough, it did stay. It's still together, and that is in early 1960s. And I still have that guitar, and that's the first one that I stamped the serial number in.
Now the preacher was up in that tree, I think it was all night. He said, Mr. Bear, if you bother me, I'll give you an awful fight. Just about that time the limb let go and the preacher came tumbling down. You could see him a-getting his razor out before he hit the ground. Now he hit the ground a-cutting right and left, put up a very good fight. Then the bear grabbed the preacher and he squeezed him a little too tight.
So that's you know, sort of the first guitar that I ever made. And then I used to spend the nights with my grandmother when my grandfather passed away. Down there one afternoon, the local moonshiner fella came in. And anyway, he had this stranger with him. We knew the moonshiner fella, but that stranger with him, we figured he's got to be a crook, you know, of some kind. And he said he wanted to see my guitar. He had heard I'd made a guitar. He sat down, and I showed him my guitar, and he sat down and played. He could play real good. And even though I was scared to death of him, he was really bragging on my guitar. He said, "I believe it's the best guitar I've ever heard," you know. I was real proud of that, but I was still scared of him. And then after a while, he got to wanting to buy it. And I thought, well, I don't want to sell my guitar, and especially to him, you know. I got with my granny and told him I'm just going to price it so astronomically high that it'll scare him off. And I told him, well, I'd sell the guitar, but I'd have to have $500 for it. And that is more money than I'd ever seen or heard tell of, you know. And so he played another tune and then left. And I told my granny, that worked. That got rid of him, you know. And then the very next afternoon when I went down there, here that fella came in by himself. And he said, "I want to play that guitar again." And he sat down and played 30 minutes or so. And he said, "Well, I think I'll just take a guitar." And he had five $100 bills in his shirt pocket. And I was flabbergasted. But I took that money and bought a shop smith and I bought a bunch of clamps and machine stuff that I needed or just dreamed about ever having. So that really was a big help. So that's sort of the story about me getting started making guitars. And I've been at that sort of thing ever since.
What do you love about it so much? And what do you bring to the making that's so special?
I do tune and test every piece of wood I put in an instrument. Every piece of that guitar, before you even carve it or make it, will talk to you. You pick it up and tap on it and see how it rings, what tone it has, what pitch. Each component has important ring qualities to them. It might be something I don't know that anybody can explain. You test every piece of your instrument you're putting together. And I think occasionally one will go together that's just exceptional. And the reason old instruments, you know, tend to sound good, one that's in good shape, you know, that's been together for years. And I've heard all kinds of stories about the molecules in the wood, you know, how the vibration, it runs back and forth through the grain of wood. And the more it does that, they say it lines those molecules up so they operate easier. You know, a nice old guitar or violin or something that's been around for years and gets played and vibrated, I think that's the reason it sounds better than a brand new one. You work and carve that shape, that piece, to where it vibrates the easiest. And then when you put all that together, I think that's when you end up with the best instrument.
Guitarist and luthier Wayne Henderson. He was joined in the studio by his lifelong friend Herb Key. The exhibit, The Luthier's Craft, Instrument Making Traditions of the Blue Ridge, wraps up at the Mount Airy Museum of Regional History this Saturday night, February 8th at 7 o'clock, with a dinner concert featuring Wayne Henderson and friends. It'll be a small venue show, limited to just 70 people, with a lot of audience interaction. Wayne will present the guitar he built for the exhibition, perform, share stories like the great one we just heard, and mingle with the crowd during dinner. Dinner's provided by Old North State Winery, and you'll find links to more information and photos of Wayne and Herb live in Studio A at WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a short break now. When we get back, Allison Slaby will walk us through the amazing artistic output of American Moderns from 1910 to 1960, and Stained Glass Playhouse director, actor Harold Clater Jr. helps us all follow our own inner North Star. That's coming up next on Triad Arts Weekend. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. This weekend, North Star, written by Gloria Bond Clooney and directed by Harold Claytor Jr., comes to the Stained Glass Playhouse in Winston-Salem. Harold's a 1997 graduate of the Portland Actors Conservatory, and he's performed professionally in numerous plays. As the son of two civil rights pioneers, Harold's perfectly suited in his new role with the Playhouse. Clooney's drama, North Star, centers on the movement of the 1960s, humanizing the great issues surrounding it by zeroing in on one family and showing how they affected a child named Aurelia and her parents. Harold spoke with me recently about the play. And in full disclosure, WFDD's own Catherine Mobley plays the role of Relia's mother, Kate Taylor, in the Stained Glass production of North Star.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around.
So, North Star, tell me about the play.
It is set in 1960 in Henderson, North Carolina. It's a coming-of-age story about a young girl named Relia. She wants to participate in the sit-ins and the movement, the civil rights movement that's going on. And it actually causes conflict between her parents because her father wants her to and her mother doesn't. And the story is told in hindsight by the older Aurelia. It begins with the N-word being said. And it's the adult version of the character Aurelia. Her daughter gets called that by a cab driver in a northern city. So it sets off a train of memories for her back to the time when she wanted to participate in the civil rights movement and how she felt when she was called that word by a white person during the demonstrations. Mm-hmm. So it's an emotional journey, and she's trying to find her North Star, which is your guiding light in your heart, not the actual star in the sky, to resolve this issue and how she should deal with it for her daughter, because she remembers how she felt and how her parents dealt with it. And she actually has some bitterness and resentment towards her father for putting her, allowing her to be in that situation and not stepping in when it happened.
Mm. And the parents divided about her participation in the movement?
Yes. Yes. Her mother feels she's too young because she knows, you know, it was hostile then. The threat of death was always looming.
We're talking 1960?
1960, yes. So her mother doesn't want her to, and her father does. So that culminates into a pretty significant discussion between them right before the demonstration.
How this play begins with her reflecting on the first time she heard that word uttered at her, mm-hmm. toward her. I remember the first time I was called Brownie, growing up in Detroit, and it's stinging. It's something you never really, I was 5 years old, but you never right. quite forget that.
Right, and that's kind of what she goes through. She never forgot it. The character and I, the lead playing Aurelia, we talked, and we decided that she moved up north to escape the South and the degradation. And like a lot of black people, they thought the North was an escape from the racism, but then they went up north and found out that it, you know, wasn't. It was different. Might not have been as blatant as it was down south. But she found that she didn't escape it. Mm-hmm. And so now she has to deal with explaining this to her daughter and helping her daughter overcome that pain.
Your connection to the movement runs deeper than just directing a play.
Fortunately, I was born after integration occurred, so I went to integrated schools all of my life. But due to my family's history on both sides of my family, very active in the civil rights movement, very active, you know, at the local level, very active with pursuing equality, making sure the black kids were educated just as well as the white kids. My dad actually attended Christiansburg Industrial Institute, which was founded by Booker T. Washington and was one of the top schools for black students back in the day. It was a boarding school, had a large campus.
Where was that?
Christiansburg, Virginia. One building still standing, but they have a pretty extensive website talking about the history of it. My mother was the first to desegregate schools in Virginia. She was that first class. And to hear the stories that she experienced, you know, it was difficult. Mm. It was that fear, especially when you're in a town predominantly white, very few blacks. She always recounted the story of her father going to the principal the first day of school and telling him, "The law says they have to go to school here, and I don't want any problems, so let's make this as smooth as we can."
Your brush with the ravages of racism in this neck of the woods equally is personal.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've been called every name but a child of God, at, you know, actually more so out west when I lived out west and down south when I lived in Nevada. It was interesting.
What's it like in the context of North Star as the director? You're dealing with obviously a heightened personal involvement in the movement through your family and your own experiences, but taking those and bringing them out in this play, how do you balance that?
It really wasn't that difficult. The oldest person in the cast is in his 60s, so he came up during that time period. But what we found is the younger generation, they have limited knowledge about that era and the fear that people lived under. You know, if your father didn't come home at night, you're wondering, did they get him? Are you going to find him somewhere? Did he get lynched? Did he going to find him in the river or the creek? To get them to understand that fear, because in today's time, you know, you can walk pretty much freely down the street and not have to worry about, you know, being lynched. For the most part, not like, you know, in those days. So getting them to understand that and encouraging them to research some history, watch YouTube videos on the demonstrations, the music that we're using, the civil rights movement, you know, music from that era, to learn that and to, you know, get an appreciation for it. Encourage the younger people to talk to their grandparents to, you know, kind of get a sense of how it was back then.
From the director's chair, you get to keep track of what's going on throughout the play also by going straight to the source. What was your conversation with Gloria Bond Clooney like, the playwright?
It was a very wonderful conversation. I was a little nervous when I was handed her phone number, email address, because you just never really know how that's going to go, how the playwright's going to be. It's not often that you get to talk to a playwright, because most plays that are done, the playwright's deceased. So you're kind of guessing how they would have wanted it done or how they viewed it. Well, I was fortunate enough to talk to her and received input. I let her know that we had already committed to the decisions we had made. So then she asked me about three scenes in particular, how I handled them.
Hmm.
And I handled them according to how she envisioned them being done.
When she gave you those three specific scenes that you wanted to go over, were any of them a surprise to you? Or were those the three that you would have said, oh yeah, she'll probably choose these three to go over?
I had no idea. Looking back on it, I understand why she asked about those, because there is the audience is asked to participate in an indirect way. They are drawn into two of the scenes she spoke about.
Hmm.
And then the third scene she asked about is the most surreal scene of them all, is when the younger Relia, who's 13, sees the adult Relia and they have interactions. So that's when it gets very surreal.
Is there a scene in the play that's your challenge to bring this moment off in the context of the play? Or?
Oh, a lot of them were. one in particular, there's a young boy character. His name is Willie. You have three generations. You have the older generation that pushed for voter rights in the 40s. And then you have the nonviolent movement in the 60s. And Willie kind of gives you a glimpse of the Black Panther movement to come. He's militant. He's angry. He's not scared. He doesn't understand why he can't pull out a gun and shoot them, because they're shooting at them. And there's an instance where he gets jumped and beat up. The after effects, as he's taking the pain medicine, he has a dream vision of his Uncle Frank, who was lynched. And it had been mentioned prior, you know, people allude to Uncle Frank. But in that scene, we find out that he actually saw his uncle being lynched, and that he had hid under the bed. So getting the lighting together and the chorus, the rest of the actors that aren't on stage will be the chorus behind stage to bring that eeriness and that fearfulness and the haunting nature of that scene to life. It took a little work. But the actors, again, they were very cooperative, eager to get it done, and stepped up to the plate. Great. I have an awesome cast.
Well, besides WFUD's own Catherine Mobley, let's talk about that cast. Who plays the role of Relia?
Relia is played by Anna Jolly, who is a senior at Reynolds High School.
So some young actors as well. And yes, should point out, this is Stained Glass Playhouse Community Theater at its essence.
Yes.
And
yes.
The role of Aurelia
is played by Cree Simpson. She's new to the stage. This will be her first performance.
And then Kate Taylor, mm-hmm, performed by Catherine Mobley.
Mm-hmm.
Willie?
Willie Joe Poole is played by Jordan White. Manson Taylor is played by Andrew Sharan. Franklin is played by Demario Armstrong. Hawkins is played by Tim Howe. The Reverend is played by Bill Jackson.
I think even in 2014, it's very difficult for some to perceive, and maybe North Star gets at the dual nature of society. As much as we'd like to think we're all in it together and kumbaya and everyone's getting along. Oh, sure, people appreciate racial tensions. But from your perspective, I mean, it comes into the home in real ways.
Yes, it does. With the incident that happened with Trayvon Martin and, you know, everything that went on around that, told a lot of people, that's the one you heard about. This happens a lot, you know, daily almost in some cases. And I had to share with, you know, a lot of my white friends, I have to have a different conversation with my son about the police than you do with your children. You know, generally from a white person's perspective, the police are to serve and protect. From my perspective and my life experience, they've been to harass and to instigate. And with the incident with Trayvon Martin and the laws, you know, we saw how the laws were and that man is still walking around free. I'd have a talk with my son. How you're viewed in this country still in 2014. You know, we've come a long way, but we still have quite a ways to go. You know, no matter how intelligent you are or, you know, how many friends you have from the other side, you're still viewed a certain way by the powers that be. Police, the laws that are in this country in some ways, it's not going to be executed the same for you. So you have to learn how to rise and overcome that, which was the message that I was given from as far back as I can remember.
Ain't gonna let segregation turn me around. I get to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching on in freedom.
Stained Glass Playhouse director Harold Clater Jr. North Star by Gloria Bond Clooney comes to the Playhouse Friday and Saturday, February 7th and 8th, and it'll run through the 22nd, with evening performances at 8 and weekend matinees at 3. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Marching on a freedom land.
I'm David Ford, and we'll take another little intermission before returning and plunging headlong into the world of American art. What better place to start than the Rinalda House Museum of American Art? And who better to lead the way than curator, scholar Allison Slaby, American Moderns, 1910 to 1960, from O'Keeffe to Rockwell, next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The Rinalda House Museum of American Art is poised to kick off this spring's season of modernism with an exciting new exhibit, American Moderns, 1910 to 1960, from O'Keeffe to Rockwell. Rinalda House is one of only two venues in the entire Southeast to feature this touring exhibition organized by the Brooklyn Museum in New York. The 53 paintings and 4 sculptures by well-known early 20th century artists like Georgia O'Keeffe, Stuart Davis, Grandma Moses, and Norman Rockwell will be on view at the same time as works in Rinalda's collection by the same artists. Rinalda curator Allison Slaby spoke with me about this rare opportunity to visit these incredible works of art side by side.
The exhibition really opens with a bang because we walk into the gallery and you see 3 walls of incredible cubist works. And, you know, that's deliberate. We want to entice our visitors, but also challenge our visitors. I mean, abstract art is challenging. You have the feeling that you're supposed to figure out what a painting means. And we're asking our visitors just to stand in front of these works and experience them. There's a great quote by an artist in the exhibition, George L.K. Morris, who's also an artist from our collection. And he said, "Abstract paintings are not puzzles. They are not difficult to understand. They need only to be looked at as one might look at a tree or a stone itself, and not as a representation of one." So they're not trying to represent something. They're just supposed to be experienced for what they are.
So from Cubism, where next?
From Cubism, you go into an exploration of the way artists in this period were exploring landscapes and motifs from nature. There's a section on Americana, which includes Grandma Moses and Norman Rockwell. There's a section on modern cityscapes, and there's a section on the people who live in those urban environments.
Grandma Moses, what is it about her art that has not only withstood the test of time, but I mean, she's in this group with Norman Rockwell's of the world and the other artists we've mentioned.
Well, her work is very appealing. If you think about what was happening during this period, there were two world wars. There was an economic depression. There was dizzying technological advance, social changes. So her work, which shows kind of an old-fashioned view of American life, was comforting. It was appealing to people who felt unsettled by the speed of all of these changes.
So it was appropriate for that time, but now it's 2014 now, looking back on the artwork. Is it just that longing for a simpler time that makes it have that staying power?
Yeah, I think it has a real nostalgic appeal.
What do you think visitors will be most surprised by at the exhibit?
I think they'll be surprised by how different artists during this period approach their work, from the Cubists to the more realists, that these people were working at the same time, sometimes influencing each other, sometimes arguing with each other, but that there was such a divergent array of styles during this period.
Were they chatting amongst themselves a lot? Was there a lot of cross-fertilization going on?
Certainly. You know, if you think about an artist like Georgia O'Keeffe, she was part of this modernist circle kind of around Alfred Stieglitz, who was the great champion of modernism in New York. But there were other members of his circle as well who were also part of this exhibition, Marston Hartley and Max Weber and Arthur Dove. They were certainly all talking to each other. There was another circle kind of around Robert Henry and an artist like George Bellows, who's in the exhibition, was part of that kind of gritty urban school of artists. So, yes, they were talking to each other. Sometimes there were factions who were warring with each other, but they were talking to each other.
No, to have been a fly in the wall. And I guess you could call it the resurgence of one of the American moderns, Norman Rockwell. And he's all over the place today.
He's certainly attracting a lot of attention. There is a new biography of him by Deborah Solomon that is getting a lot of press. It was Garrison Keillor reviewed it in the New York Times. A painting, Saying Grace, sold last year at auction at Sotheby's for $46 million. So that's a record for the artist. So he really is attracting a lot of attention. And the painting in the exhibition by him is, I think, one that's going to find a lot of appeal for visitors. It's called The Tattoo Artist. He's talking about him in comparison to Georgia O'Keeffe. She's an artist who approaches modernity as an artist. I think he approaches modernity as a storyteller. He is also addressing the kind of disorienting effects of the 20th century, but he does it with humor. So the tattoo artist is a World War II sailor who is going to the tattoo parlor to have the name of his latest girlfriend inked on his arm. But he's also having the names of the previous girlfriends crossed off. And so he's had a girl in every port. And we have heard rumors out there in the community that tattoo enthusiasts will drop everything and travel across the state just to see this painting. So we'll have programs around tattoos and a special tattoo night. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Great. I'll go get my tattoo.
Welcome to my life, tattoo. I'm a man now, thanks to you. I expect I'll regret you.
What's not to be missed, though? If there's something I just don't want to miss out on for this exhibit, what is it?
I think it's the chance to see five works by Georgia O'Keeffe in one museum, four in the exhibition and one from our collection. I think that's going to be really appealing for our visitors.
So you're calling this spring a season of modernism at the museum, a whole season of modernism. What does that mean?
Well, we want to really communicate the idea that Rinalda itself is a modern place. And, you know, when it was built in 1917, it was very advanced. The design and the architecture were very advanced. Catherine Reynolds was a visionary in terms of, you know, kind of embracing modern home design.
And landscaping.
And landscaping, exactly. Her daughter, Mary Reynolds Babcock, made streamlined modern additions to the home, especially in the basement. So we have this whole season of concerts, plays, lectures, exploring this idea of modernism, both in the exhibition and then in Rinalda itself.
What do you all provide that other museums may not have that enables you to access exhibits of this quality?
Well, this exhibition is from Brooklyn, and Brooklyn is an incredible museum with an absolutely comprehensive collection. I think what attracted us to this exhibition and what made us an attractive venue is the caliber of our collection. And so we're installing this large exhibition of 57 works in our large gallery in the Babcock Wing. But to complement this exhibition, when we were planning this show, we were really struck by how much overlap there was between the artists and this exhibition and our own collection. So we created a complementary exhibition called Rinalda Moderns, which is an exhibition of 8 works in a gallery in the historic house of artists from our collection or incoming loans to our collection of artists that are featured in the Brooklyn show. And we're doing something I think really fun and unusual, which is that if you're standing in front of the Stuart Davis from Brooklyn in the Babcock Wing, there will be a little teaser line that says, interested in Stuart Davis, go find this painting in the historic house. And then when you go to Rinalda Moderns, there will be a QR code. And if you have a smartphone, you can scan the QR code and there will be a little 90-second video called Modern Minute of one of our experts talking about that painting. And it's experts from our museum, from Rinalda House, but also David Lubin and Jay Curley from the art department at Wake and Belinda Tate from Diggs Gallery at Winston-Salem State. So we really pulled some of our nearest and dearest to get their perspectives on the works in our collection.
Rinalda House Museum of American Art curator Allison Slaby. The exhibition American Moderns, 1910 to 1960, from O'Keeffe to Rockwell, opens Friday, February 7th, and it'll remain on view through May 4th. Visitors can learn even more from local art scholars in their 90-second videos available on the museum's website. And this spring, Rinalda House is keeping it modern in lots of ways, including late-night Thursdays. Beginning in March, the first Thursday of the month, you'll find the doors open till 8 o'clock and the museum filled with a different music performance and new program each night through May 1st. You'll find complete program information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts Weekend, along with pictures and lots of helpful links, on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.